1, 2, 3. Acoustic Encounters with David Nogrisman and Danny Barnes.
Hello, acoustic music lovers. You're listening to Acoustic Encounters. My name's Danny Barnes.
And my name's David Dog Grisman.
Grisman and Barnes. Barnes and Grisman.
There you go, man.
It's a law firm.
Like a vaudeville act.
One question I have is, who is this Bill Monroe character you keep talking
man,
about?
Man, I'll be damned if I know, Danny. Some guy that invented bluegrass.
Okay, what's bluegrass? No, I'm kidding. Man, we got Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys live at Mechanics Hall.
That's right, in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Worcester, Massachusetts. That must have been a classic venue. Tell us about Mechanics Hall.
Well, you know, I made this tape when I was 18 years old. And when we decided to release this recording decades later, I did some research on Mechanics Hall, and it's one of the oldest concert halls in America.
No kidding.
But my recollection, it was kind of a big, run-down place, you know, at the time. And the years since then, it had been restored, and it was a beautiful concert hall.
What's the significance of the mechanic bit? It sounds like a trade union kind of
thing. Yeah, it was kind of a trade union.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
They had an association, and they outgrew their rented spaces and embarked on a plan to build their own hall.
And what's the name of the town again?
Worcester.
Worcester.
Yeah,
wow.
It's W-O-R-C-E. Mm-hmm. Worcester is how you might mistakenly pronounce
it. Yeah, Worcestershire sauce.
Yeah, kind of like that. Yeah.
So you recorded this when you were just a kid. How did you get out there, if you don't mind me asking? Gets a pretty good far away from your house.
You know, I don't think we drove there. When I went to master this recording, I noticed on the tape, somebody was saying, testing, testing, testing. And I didn't recognize the voice. And I called up all kinds of people, Winnie Winston, Fred Weiss, asked him if was that them, because I didn't remember. And a few years after the record had come out, I was having dinner at a friend's house, and Jody Stecker was there, and I told the story, and he said, oh, that was me.
Wow.
And Jody remembered everything about it.
No kidding.
He said we stayed in the Harvard dorms somehow, and maybe we took a bus. I don't know. Maybe we got a ride with somebody from Cambridge. Huh. It was a big show. I was friends with Bill Keith by then, and he, of course, was in the band.
Was he a couple of years older than you or younger?
Oh, yeah.
You were 18. How old was he?
Well, he was born in 1939, so this would be 63. So he was about 23 years old.
Oh, wow. That's a lot when you're that age.
Yeah.
You know?
He was older. It was a big concert. It was a triple bill. Grandpa Jones.
So good.
And the Lilly Brothers and Don Stover, and then Bill Monroe.
Man. And Bill's at the height of his career as far as like having the killer band, you know.
Well, that was a great band with Bill Keith and Del McCurry, a legendary band. And, of course, Bessie Lee, the Carolina songbird, was playing bass, as she had for quite a few years. And at that time, Joe Stewart was playing fiddle.
Wow.
Later, Kenny Baker was off and on with Bill Monroe. But Joe Stewart was an interesting character. He's the only bluegrass boy that played all five instruments
in the
band, including mandolin. Because his first gig in August of 1955, Bill had a broken collarbone, and Joe Stewart played mandolin.
Man, that's some trivia there.
Yeah. And I believe my good friend Artie Rose took pictures of that.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And Joe Stewart also played banjo, guitar.
Now, I didn't know that. Is there examples of his playing the banjo?
He did a lot of recording with Bill Monroe.
His fiddling is awesome. He's one of the greats, you know. Bass too, you say?
Yeah, he played bass. He also played bass with Flat and Scruggs.
No kidding.
Yeah, briefly, yeah.
Wow.
He was like an all-purpose side man.
Wow.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. Versatility helps, you know.
Jody was there too.
Jody was there.
Was there just
too,
in attendance?
Yeah.
He wasn't recording it like y'all was. So.
I used to bring my Wallensack tape machine everywhere.
That's so cool. Did you just put up a mic up there by the main mic?
It was that Electra voice.
The one that looks like a ray gun, has an on and off switch on it.
Pretty good sounding tape.
It was a Wallensack. Was it a stereo deck or a mono deck?
This was a Monaural recording and still is.
Can I ask, how was Grandpa Jones? Did he play by himself or did he have guys with him?
I believe he had his wife, Ramona,
far out,
playing guitar with him. Yeah, he was great.
I loved him.
Ralph Rinsler turned me on to Grandpa. Old Rattler and Mountain Dew.
Yeah, man. He had a great 8 more miles of Louisville and everything.
Of course, I'm my own grandpa. He frailed the banjo, and that was a great act, and I recorded everything, but by the time it got to Bill Monroe, I was running out of tape.
Lord.
So I had to go over most of that.
Yeah.
I think I had a few songs by the Lilly Brothers.
The very first concert I think I ever went to was Grandpa Jones and String Bean at the War Memorial in Temple about 1970.
Wow.
How do the Lilly Brothers sound?
And oh, they sounded great.
Was it them and Don only?
Yeah,
just
Don
the three?
Stover, yes.
Just the three of them?
I think they had a bass player. I think maybe one of their sons.
They were playing a lot in Boston, right?
Yeah, at the Hillbilly Melody Ranch.
Hillbilly Ranch.
Yeah, I went there a few times too.
So you went to that club and saw the Lilly Brothers there?
Yeah, I remember sitting in there. And I think Buzz Busby was there playing guitar when I played there. I mean, I wasn't on the bill or anything. Somebody invited me up to play. Bill Keith used to hang out there a lot.
Really?
Well, he was heavy into Don Stover.
Yeah, yeah.
As man. Are you.
Yeah, oh, man. I can't even believe it. You got to see him like that with the Lilly Brothers. That's so cool.
Well, they were really heavily influenced by the Monroe Brothers.
Yeah, they kind of represented sort of a little bit of the pre-bluegrass in a way, didn't they?
They did, yeah. They had a great duet sound, and of course, Everett played with Flat and Scruggs and made some recordings.
Did he sing high tenor and sing Charlie's part?
Yeah, he sang tenor.
Did he ever play solos?
Yeah, he did.
No kidding.
I think he's playing on Earl's Breakdown.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. That's
Everett.
I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
He had that killer voice, too. He's a great singer. If you had to have a substitute, that's a good substitute right there.
During this show, Bill invited B, who was the guitar player, to come and sing a duet with him. And one of the Monroe Brothers classics, What Would You Give
what
in Exchange?
That's a good one.
For Your Soul.
That's a good one. One thing I wanted to ask you about, David, that track, Love's Gonna Live Here Again, which I thought was real interesting about that. I looked it up, and Love's Gonna Live Here Again came out maybe a couple of months before this show.
Right.
And so Bill was playing this song off Top 40 Radio, which I thought was far out.
His daughter, Melissa, sang it.
Uh-huh.
That was a Buck Owens hit.
Yeah. It came out just a few weeks, so it would have been like, you know, just like a super contemporary song to pick.
Right.
I thought that was interesting.
Bluegrass musicians were trying to stay relevant or be relevant. The advent of rock and roll was so damaging to this idiom that was just blossoming. It was expanding and evolving and incredible music being played by all these great bands, Jimmy Martin and Jim and Jesse and Reno and Smiley and the Stanley Brothers. And all of a sudden, here comes Elvis and Carl Perkins and boom, you know, just knocked it.
Uh-huh.
Bluegrass was really hurting on the economic and business level. These guys were trying to survive.
I thought it was a cool pick and a cool song and a cool track. I enjoyed it.
I thought
it was cool. Maybe she just liked to sing it or it fit her voice good or something.
I know she made some records for Columbia in the early 50s, and I don't think they were bluegrass records.
Yeah. I guess it'd make more sense for her to be a country singer.
Want to listen to that?
Yeah, let's listen to
that. I mean, it's an oddball cut to start with.
Yeah, I love that track. Here we go.
And now, friends, I have a little surprise for you here tonight. I'd like to introduce a little lady that's really mighty proud of, and I hope you'll enjoy singing here tonight. She comes out here. Let's give her a nice hand. She's my daughter, Melissa. Let's make her welcome. What do you say? And Melissa's going to sing one of George Jones's numbers entitled, Love's Gonna Live Here. Thank you. really appreciate the nice hand from Melissa.
She sang it great.
Yeah, written by Buck Owens, and apparently it was number one for 16 weeks.
Whoa, number one.
Yeah.
Wow. Man, I love Bill Keith's backup banjo playing. Man, Joe Stewart, what a great fiddler. That's a great solo, I thought.
Yeah, he did it all.
Hey, man, what was the deal with Bessie Lee Maudlin? It's hard to find much information about her, but she must have been a good musician.
She was a good bass player, had a real good touch.
When you saw her play, she sounded good, right?
Yeah. Kept good time. And
she's on a lot of the records, right?
She's on almost every session from 1955 on through the late 80s.
No kidding.
Yeah, she's on a lot of sessions. She was, of course, Bill's girlfriend and traveled with the band. And the Carolina Songbird.
She was kind of cool. I've drawn her a bunch. I like to draw her. And with the bass, you know, like the shape of her with the bass.
Yeah,
and her
platinum
hair.
Blonde.
Yeah, yeah. Big, lot of hair, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Those dresses and everything.
Yeah.
Real interesting.
I think there were a lot of female bass players in country music.
When I was going to like local regional festivals as a kid, there was a lot of lady bass players that'd be really good. Guys would just get interested in the banjo, and then they'd just get their wife and show them how to do it, but they'd be really good at bluegrass.
I'm married to one. She's out playing a gig right now.
Yeah, like there's some good bass players, you know. But she sang and everything. She was. Did she ever make her own records, you think?
I'm not sure about that. I saw quite a few shows, including the first time I saw Bill Monroe.
Now, that's real Bill Monroe with her in the band. That's to me, is a classic era of Bill Monroe with her in the band. What a bunch of great young players, too. Lordy. Dell in there.
Yeah, of course, the story about Dell and Bill Keith showing up the same day, both carrying banjos, both having been invited by Bill to come play banjo. I read in the notes to this, which are really some wonderful notes by Neil Rosenberg.
It's really beautiful.
The ultimate bluegrass scholar. He said that it was Ralph Rinsler that, you know, when Bill heard Bill Keith play, he told Dell Bill Keith had the job. And Ralph suggested that he try him out. Maybe Ralph knew how good a singer and guitar player Dell was. He suggested that he audition him on guitar and singing. The way Dell tells it is that Bill auditioned both Bill Keith and Dell McCurry on both instruments and sorted them out that way. But however it went down, it was a great combination. It only lasted pretty much in the year 1963.
There's a recording of Dell playing banjo. Where in the timeline is that?
That must have been Peter Siegel's tape that was made, I think it was February 8th, 1963, at NYU, where we both were students, Peter and I, and Bill Monroe stopped in Baltimore on his way up to New York and went into a bar where Jack Cook was playing.
Wow.
Jack Cook had worked with Bill, great guitar player and singer, and Dell was his banjo player at the time. Dell's a really good banjo player, and Bill hired them both to go up to New York.
I see.
I don't think Dell ever recorded with Bill Monroe in a studio, but that tape of that first gig, right out of the box, I don't even think they rehearsed. And Dell really sounded great on that. I think some of those songs ended up on a Friends of Old Time Music. That was the organization that sponsored these concerts in New York and other places. There's a Smithsonian Folkways compilation that Peter Siegel put together. He recorded a lot of these concerts. He had a Tandberg tape machine.
Fancy one, huh? It was the same speed as a Wolensack?
Well, I think they both ran at 3 3/4 and 7.5.
What was your favorite speed? Did you like the length?
Well, 7.5.
Yeah, but did it more tape?
Yeah. I think when I recorded the Osborne Brothers at the Coral Bar, I started at 7.5. They played 3 or 4 sets, and by the end of the night, I was switched to 3 3/4, you know.
Kind of cool for the bass. Sometimes those slower speeds, kind of like the bass gets bigger sometimes.
Yeah, that's accepted opinion, especially between 15 inches per second and 30 inches per second. They say the bass response is better at 15.
So let's see. We've covered Joe Stewart and Bessie Lee and Dell and Bill Keith on there. Was there anybody else that was a guest that we haven't covered on that? We talked about B, Melissa.
Well, what would you like to listen to?
I was kind of curious about their Devil's Dream on just because as a banjo player, that was a huge tune.
Well, that was one of the tunes that Bill Keith brought into the bluegrass banjo repertoire as one of the fiddle tunes that Keith worked out note for note. It hadn't been really done before.
Where do you think he got the note for note version from? Was there a fiddler he was hanging out with, you think?
You mean the actual notes of it?
Yeah. Was it Kenny Baker he was playing with, or who was he?
He had worked this out before he was in the band. That's a good question. You'd have to ask Bill, but of course he ain't around. I'm not sure which version of Devil's Dream. He might have got it from Tommy Jackson. Or There were a lot of recorded versions of that tune. It was pretty popular.
Well, I didn't know that. I didn't know anything about that tune, really. It was kind of a popular fiddle instrumental outside of bluegrass.
Yeah, I think it was fairly well known. We'll give it a listen. Here.
Please.
All right, now it's banjo picking time, and we want to listen to Brad Keith here pick this old timer for you. This is a number that we have on Decca Record. It's our latest release out. It's entitled The Devil's Dream. Can't beat that kind of banjo picking there. That's really mighty fine.
And he lit him up pretty good with that one, didn't he?
Yeah.
It's like a 50 caliber machine gun there, man. Unbelievable playing. That must have freaked people out when they first heard him play.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of like Earl a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, it was like kind of the second coming.
Is that right?
Just like when Earl Scruggs started playing with Bill Monroe on the Grand Ole Opry, they'd say, Bill and Earl with that fancy banjo.
Oh, no kid.
I bet you Bill Monroe kind of felt a little conflicted. He liked these guys and had them in his band, but I think he was a little trepidatious about being upstaged.
Mm-hmm.
Probably by the time Bill Keith got in the band, he probably looked at it as
an asset.
Well, not only an asset, but there was a big rivalry between Monroe and Flatt and Scruggs at that time.
I got you.
Especially
he had a better
in the
banjo
early
player.
60s when the Beverly Hillbillies, Flatt and Scruggs was getting a lot of attention. And I bet you he thought, well, I'll show you how the banjo should be played now. You know,
yeah.
That's just my own
Makes sense. Yeah, he was doing it. He was sure doing it right there. Man, that was unbelievable.
Yeah, playing. He was. And
he still had that old-time sound. Like, he still had, like, a good flathead banjo, probably a skinhead, you know. I don't know. Just, he was really getting a thick, big sound, you know.
Well, I don't think it was a skinhead then, but, you know, he had that top tension flathead. I guess Tom Morgan made the neck for that.
Really big sound.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Another interesting thing about that song and the way Bill introduced Bill Keith, he called him Brad.
Yeah.
Which was Bill Keith's middle name, Bradford, at the time. Bill Monroe, he didn't want two Bills in the band. So he called him Brad, and I always called him Brad after that.
You did?
Yeah.
You did?
Yeah.
I always called him Mr. Keith.
Oh.
Y'all were old friends, though. He knew where to find your apartment there in the Greenwich Village, didn't he?
Yeah, we had a lot of fun.
He was really setting it on fire right there. Now, if you don't mind me asking, when did the recordings of him playing with Monroe come out?
As Bill Monroe mentioned, that it was started coming out right away. I guess maybe Devil's Dream was the first, but they did Salt Creek. There were several of them.
Sailor's Hornpipe?
Yeah, Sailor's Hornpipe and Shenandoah Breakdown.
Oh, yeah.
Right after Bill Keith joined that band, Bill Monroe took them right into the studio. And I think Del McCurry wasn't on that session because he wasn't in the union yet.
Huh.
But Bill Keith was, and he just recorded banjo tunes. He knew he was onto something, and he wanted to be the first one there with that.
I can imagine that Devil's Dream probably got a lot of airplay from, like, radio stations because it's a great tune to go to the commercial on and play at the top of the hour and all that, you know?
Well, it really shook up us bluegrass kids, you know? And a lot of banjo players started learning those licks. I don't know about Earl Scruggs, but you can even hear J.D. Crow.
Someone told me there's a record, maybe it was Hartford told me this, that there's a tape of him playing melodic banjo.
Really?
Yeah. Somewhere there's a tape that exists of him playing Bill Cheatham or something with Bill Keith's licks in it.
Of course, Bobby Thompson, who played with Jim and Jesse, also was an innovator in that style.
Yeah, you got that right.
Very similar licks, maybe before Bill Keith, early 60s. When I met him, he was playing with Jim Rooney in Boston. It was Keith and Rooney. They made an album for Prestige with Joe Val on mandolin. And that's when Keith really started using that technique. And he'll give credit to Don Stover. I guess there's...
Yeah, I've heard him give that talk many times.
A few licks that he...
There's a lick where you put your index finger on the third string at the fifth fret and the ring finger's on the fourth string at the seventh fret. It's like a D7 sort of thing. And if you leave those other two strings open, Don figured out how to move it around and get like a part of a scale.
Uh-huh.
It might have been on a Lily Brothers recording where he first got the idea. And with that lick, he realized it was just like four notes, but he figured out he could go all the way through the scale. He used to give a talk about that.
Yeah.
What a brilliant guy he was.
Mm-hmm.
He sure sounds good on that track right there, Lord.
He sure does.
I love the way this is recorded and the way it sounds. I mean, that to me is like bluegrass right there.
Bluegrass bands were used to working a mic, you know, and most of those shows just had one or two mics. You stepped up to the mic and got out of the way when the next guy was coming. They were mixing the sound that way, the way they were working that mic. And, of course, the bluegrass players and instruments, they put out a lot of volume, so... Even though somebody was playing into the mic, you could hear the rest of it, too. Maybe we should listen to Del singing a solo number.
I think that's a great idea.
The one on here that he pretty much did a heck of a lot when he was with Bill Monroe at Dark Hollow.
Right now, we want to call on Dale McCurry for a good solo number. He does a wonderful job with this number, and it's entitled Dark Hollow.
I'd rather be in some dark hollow where the sun don't ever shine, and to be at home alone just knowing that you're gone would cause me to lose my mind. So blow your whistle, freight train, take me far on down the track. I'm going away.
How's that for a bluegrass classic?
Yeah.
Man, check out Monroe Total Punk Rock solo there on the mandolin there.
Yeah.
What was happening there? Are they having a spat right there in the middle of that?
That's his...
Yeah, that sounded good.
Classic, I don't know what you call that. Kind of reminds me of Thelonious Monk a little bit.
Yeah, that's an interesting comment, yeah. I can see that, yeah. It has like kind of like a abstraction to it, huh?
Like nothing else, really, you know, those kind of solos. And
did he do that a lot? Is that a classic sound for him?
Yeah, I think so. If you go through the records, especially in the early, mid-50s, played a lot of stuff like that. Well, Mule Skinner Blues is kind of...
Do mandolin players have a term for that when he does that? It's kind of like jamming or something, right? He sort of abandons the melody for a moment and stuff, it seems like. He really gets out into a place there.
Somewhere. It's Monroe style.
Is that right?
That's one of the big hallmarks.
Well, you know, when I see mandolin players teach Monroe style mandolin classes, doesn't seem like that part comes up.
Really?
I don't think I've ever really seen anyone address that too much educationally on the mandolin and what he's doing there. Have you studied that a lot, like work those kind of solos
out?
Yeah. Wow.
A few years later, I played that same song with Del McCurry and I love that kind of playing.
That's such a cool sound.
He really screw around with time a
lot. Did he ever have any of those that he repeated, or was every time he did that, it was kind of going for it, sort of?
Well, that classic kickoff to Mule Skinner Blues.
That's kind of like that, isn't it?
It is like that.
Yeah, you're right.
And I learned that note for note.
It's kind of like rock and roll piano playing a little. Maybe he was copping rock and roll on there, like that Little Richard right
there.
Well,
he was doing that before rock and roll, actually. There's a tune he recorded before Flat Scruggs called Bluegrass Special. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, cool. All of that. And Bluegrass Stomp is
boogie,
like
boogie,
that.
Yeah, boogie, yeah.
Yeah, it's very angular.
Mm-hmm. Because we think of fiddle tunes as being sort of like... linear or whatever.
This is like jagged and
abstract too.
Yeah, it's kind of like,
and sometimes there's notes that aren't quite in the scale, but he makes it swing really hard.
Yeah,
he's swinging like harder than the band. He's like very swinging, right?
It's super swinging. It's like, here I am, you know. He may have gotten that from Arnold Schultz, black guitar player that influenced him a lot. I think he had a lot of influences from his early days. He learned a lot from black musicians.
I see.
I think that's where that comes from.
Yeah, super hit.
Hey, we could give a listen to Mule Skinner Blues.
Yeah.
Now I have some solo numbers I'd like to do for you here tonight. Numbers that I started with on the Grand Ole Opry about 24 years ago down there. And the first number I'd like to do is a yodel number. It's entitled The Mule Skinner Blues. Good morning, Captain. Good tell you what a boogie down.
That's like the classic. It's so good. And Joe Stewart's fiddle tone on there is super cool. Did you say they were just working one mic only at this show?
I believe so. Wow. I mean, I don't have any photos from it.
Man, it sounds really good. Dell is pumping that rhythm on there, isn't he?
Yeah, he sure is. Moving. So is Bill Monroe. Man.
Yeah, they keep it moving.
Bill Monroe was a stickler for rhythm. He wouldn't let anybody get out of line. They just get that mandolin right up there, and you're behind.
Yeah, that yodeling, man, it's, I don't know, that's such a classic track. It's great to hear it live like that, too. Of course, when they recorded it, it was live, too, right? When they recorded it, they just played it, right?
Yeah. And
that was Vassar on the original?
The original, I believe, was a guy named Tommy Magnus, and I think that was around 1940.
Whoa.
Or 41, the first Bill Monroe recording. Of course, it's a Jimmy Rogers tune. I believe Bill played guitar on the original record of...
What about the kickoff?
That was the second. He called it New Mule Skinner
no
Blues.
No kid. Okay.
In 1950.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
About 10 years later, he re-recorded it with Vassar Clements on fiddle, and Bill played that kickoff.
No kidding.
Dee 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 doo doo dee doo 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 doo. I had to make a tape loop. I recorded it and then just cut that kickoff out and taped the end of it to the beginning. Just keep going round and round on the tape machine. And I just kept trying to get with it until I got with it, you know?
I had to do the same thing with Earl. I put him on a reel-to-reel and slow it down to half speed, you know? You could put the records on 16, too. That would work, too, if you had
Right. That's what I used to do. I had an AR turntable.
Yeah, it would go down there.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, there's one other one I wanted to listen to here on this track. I'd like to hear that, What Would You Give, if you don't mind hearing
it. Yeah, with B. Lilly.
Yeah.
B. Lilly. B, are you here? I would like for you to come on up here. Check and see back there. He might be back in the back there. This is the first number that I ever recorded in my life. And Charlie Monroe and myself, we recorded the number on Victor. It was a... off-brand label there, they called one of their own labels, a little side branch there, they called the Bluebird label. It was Victor, owned by Victor. B, I want you to get the guitar there and help me with this song, if you don't mind.
I was all the way back, Bill.
Is that right? Well, I always knew the people in West Virginia were slow, but I didn't know they was that slow, B.
Which key was
now, that? We'd better do that about F, hadn't we? This is the key that we recorded this in back years ago. We're going to try to do it for you. What would you give in exchange for your soul? We might not speak the words the same, but we'll do our best.
Brother or father, from the Savior today, risking your soul. Today. that you give in exchange for your soul.
Get a hand like that tonight here.
No, sir, we didn't. Man, you done got that one, no.
And if me and Charlie had sung, we wouldn't have got that good a hand either.
No, sir, man, you're the best.
We're the best.
That's right.
That'll put Everett in his place. We don't want to hear no more out of him.
That's right. Now, he don't want to argue no more.
That's right. B, you don't know how I appreciate you coming up here saying we have never sung together before.
Never.
I don't believe we ever sung a song together.
No.
And it's really a pleasure to have you here. B is from down in West Virginia, as you folks know. And we used to play through that country down there, and B and Everett would come out on the show and sing. And it's good to see you again.
Good to see you too, Bill.
Best of luck.
The good old blue.
Let's give B a hand here tonight. Come on.
Thank you.
Thank you a lot, B.
Thank you very much, Bill. Let's give Bill Monroe the hand here too, the daddy of bluegrass. He's responsible for me being here. Thank you. Thank you.
A lot of the people down on the Grand Ole Opry kid me about bluegrass. They tell it to me, you know, like I really started something, boy, when I started bluegrass. It can't be stopped, you know, that no telling where it's going to go to. But I'm really proud of the bluegrass music, and I'm glad to see people play it. To always play it the best way you can. Play it good and clean, play good melodies with it, and keep perfect time. It takes really good timing with bluegrass music, and it takes some good high voices to really deliver it right.
I think that's the only time they ever sang together.
Wow. They knew what to do, didn't they?
Yep.
Man, they sang so good, man.
That was something.
They'd never sang together before and just did that.
Yeah.
You must have really thought this is like being in heaven, right?
Yeah.
It's cool that you had the chutzpah to record it.
Yeah. Ralph Rinsler set me on that path.
And you've had this reel-to-reel laying around your stuff ever since then. The tape of
the
show.
Oh, the tape. Yeah. Well, I kept everything, and it's good that I did because...
Yeah, man. This is really good, yeah.
This is a pretty good representation of what was going on there in November of 1963.
And, you know, like you mentioned, the liner notes to this is amazing. It's very well done and
kind
of in depth.
Yeah, Neil's a great guy. He's really the preeminent bluegrass scholar.
Thanks, David.
Thank you.
See you later.
All right.
That's all we have time for.